I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Cinematic Universe, the podcast that used to be about comic book movies and TV, but this week is about a comic book movie. Not by design, it just sort of turned out that way. I'm James Hunt. Joining me this week, as ever, is...
Rhys Dickerson.
And Joe Cunningham.
This week we'll be looking at Randall Park's 2023 movie, Shortcomings, which I have chosen because in the new format, we're doing a sort of revolving movie club. Last episode, Joe chose Poor Things, which we watched and reviewed. This time I've got the guys to watch Shortcomings, which is a movie I saw at the cinema last year and have since rewatched.
I'm looking forward to learning why you wish to bring this to the movie club, but we will save that. We'll save that for later in the show. That's
it. Indeed. Before that, we're going to do our regular slots. So we're going to talk about what we've been watching in the intervening weeks.
What have I been watching? So I've seen a couple of new movies. Saw the Zone of Interest, and I saw Mean Girls.
What do you think?
About which one? Which one are you most excited for my hot take about? Mean Girls or the Zone of Interest?
Zone of Interest.
Okay. So I'm a big Jonathan Glazer fan. I kind of love all three of his... previous movies. I feel like it took me a real long time in the movie to adjust to what it was doing. I popped it on Letterboxd and I didn't pop in a star rating because I was kind of thrown, I think, by how much I knew about what the film was doing going in. And I feel like I hadn't read that much about it, but I just knew kind of like, you know, this is the perspective that the film is taking. And Jonathan Glazer is approaching it in a really formalistic manner, kind of dispassionate. Like, it feels like Jonathan Glazer's almost like shooting it like a Michael Haneke movie. I didn't feel this kind of the way that some people have described it as if like it has just this really kind of like overwhelming emotional heft, and that it kind of like it feels like impossible to exist alongside. And I kind of didn't feel that. I kind of felt like I was viewing it dispassionately, almost as much as Glazer was presenting it. So I'm kind of keen to see it again at some point. But yeah, it kind of felt like I came out being like, I like that. It's a really interesting formal exercise, but I haven't been blown away by it the same way I was the first time I watched Birth or Under the Skin.
Yeah, I've seen it twice. Saw it in Cannes and saw it last night actually. So fresh in the memory, but the same for me. The same, yeah. Kind of very interesting. It's just this one sort of very evocative, provocative idea that he has, and it's. You know, the idea is we will spend time with the family with the father that runs Auschwitz. But you'll basically spend the whole film or vast majority of the film at their house, which is just on the side of the camp, and you'll sort of follow them as they go about their kind of mundane lives, with constantly really the horrors. Mostly yeah. Sounds, to be honest, of Auschwitz in the background that you as the audience, of course, know what's happening, but the characters don't.
I'm so glad I saw it in the cinema for that reason, though, Reese. The sound design is phenomenal. And Jonathan Glazer does this really smart thing early on. Well, like literally the opening image of the movie is a dark black screen, and you are just kind of like for about a minute and a half, I would guess, kind of left there just adjusting to the film's soundscape. And there's another moment midway through the film that cuts away to a red screen to do it, and it's kind of the sounds of the film combined with Mika Levy's like really almost like primal
jarring,
scream
unsettling
score. Yeah. But that score kind of only very occasionally comes into the film.
Very brief, yeah.
So I think, yeah, I admired it more than I loved it at first watch, but I would be very keen to go back into it. Because as well, I think so much of the film is about the banality of their experience and the dispassionate way that really horrific things are dealt with around the edges of their life. And kind of, so if I can imagine going into this blind at a film festival, or fairly blind at a film festival, having that kind of like, holy shit reaction. But knowing as much as I did about it, I didn't feel like I could. But I'd be very keen to see it again. And also, crucially, it's better than Mean Girls.
Okay.
Reese, do you want to tell us what you've been up to?
Oh, me? Yes. So Joe's done. That's it. He's two and out.
I could tell you. I could tell you a bit more. I've watched some Mae West movies. Watched some Spike Lee movies. Bottoms. I watched Bottoms. Marshawn Lynch. I enjoyed his movie debut in that.
Oh, he's good.
Just to point out, you've watched 14 movies since we last did. since you watched Shortcomings, in fact.
Yes. No. So that is not 14 movies since we last did the podcast.
Yeah.
14 movies since I watched Shortcomings.
I watched. What do you think of Bottoms?
I thought Bottoms was. Again, do you know, I was a weird one, so I watched that one at home, obviously, because it's just been added to Amazon Prime. I feel like it took me a while to adjust to, but for a different reason, because I just kind of knew the premise, and I didn't know kind of how goofy and elevated the world that the movie existed in would be. And it took me a while to kind of adjust to, this whole world, this is not set in a realistic high school world.
It's a cartoon. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, it's a cartoon world, and it's all very silly, and the escalation.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like by the final set piece, I was like, oh, yeah, I'm with this, I get what it's doing. And so, again, I kind of like to rewatch it at some point in the future, because I feel like, if I am on its wavelength going in, I laughed enough throughout the runtime that I'm like, maybe I will enjoy that a lot more. But I would say for the moment, I quite liked it. But Marshawn Lynch, an incredible, introductory comedic performance. Like, Marshawn Lynch, who was a former NFL player and was kind of like, famous for his personality, like on and off the field, and so it was no surprise that he was doing what he was doing. And I'd kind of seen him kind of do that kind of thing in press conferences and adverts and talk shows and whatnot, but like he's really effortless in it, and especially, you know, you get like a glimpse in the post credits of how much they're all riffing and improvising within scenes, and yeah, he just feels like a natural, and you're like, you are probably going to be able to stick that guy in maybe like 5 to 10 movies over the next few years. It's going to be the same kind of shtick in everyone, but he's real funny. Like he'll probably get a decent run out of that, and I will laugh every time he turns up on screen. But lots of the women got in Bottoms too, by the way.
Guess we know who's on the Oscars panel for this podcast.
I'll go. I'll do two TV things. Two hot current TV thingies.
Great.
I'm watching True Detective, Night Country, which because of the Super Bowl, I mean, it's sort of airing Sundays on HBO and now on Mondays on Now, but because of the Super Bowl, the fifth and penultimate episode popped up yesterday, which I haven't watched yet, but so it's, you know, almost at the end of it. I've been disappointed with it, I think.
Can I ask you a question?
One of you guys are watching.
Have you, I assume you watched the first series of True Detective. Have you watched all of them, or is this your first one since then?
I watched one and I definitely didn't finish two, and I didn't watch three at all. So, first for a while.
Which seems to be the experience that actually sounds like the kind of the most common True Detective experience of people liked the first season. I didn't. And then the second one, no one liked. The third one kind of turned up after a long time away, and no one really paid that much attention, even though it was Mahershala Ali. And then this one seems to have got people back in again. And it seems to have got people back in again, Reese, tell me if I'm wrong, partly based on vibe and partly based on it's referring back to the first series that people liked.
I think that's what I was expecting. I just haven't found those things as ins for the show, to be honest. I think the key issue that the show is, you know, again, we're pretty much done now, is the dynamic between the two central cops for me is nothing. It's not interesting enough. It barely has any kind of friction, to be honest. And they're both compelling enough in their own ways. I think Callie Reese, you know, she's got a presence, definitely, and Jodie Foster's always
good.
She's
like a former boxer or something.
Former boxer, yeah. Although they haven't really used that physicality apart from, I guess, in the most recent episode, or episode four, they used that a bit. But I don't know, it's just a bit, somehow it's a bit generic. And I think the thing with the first season of True Detective, the reason it connected through if we're being honest, it's mostly those performances, but it's also some of that writing that Pizzolatto had. And you know that he might be a one show and out kind of guy, and he had these ideas for this one series. But you know, time is a flat circle, and Psychosphere, and lots of lines out of McConaughey's mouth have stuck in the culture since then, and that's not nothing. And this doesn't have anything like that, and it's got an interesting setting, but it's not like we haven't seen stuff set in, you know, in the dead of night Alaska, where it's sort of the sun doesn't come up for a period. We've seen it like 30 days of night.
We've covered on this podcast. I was about to say 30 days of night, yeah.
I don't think we ever did cover that on this podcast, did we? We could have done.
I'm not going to spoil my choice for next episode quite yet. I just don't really get the praise. I just don't. And I think the mystery is very scattered. I'm not interested with how it's going to resolve, to be honest. The links back to the previous season they're pretty few and far between. I'm gonna finish it, but disappointed. But I tell you a thing that I have fucking loved this week, absolutely loved, really loved, is Mr. and Mrs. Smith on Prime. I don't know if you guys have dipped into that. That is terrific, terrific. I've watched 5 of the 8 episodes. I dropped them all at once last week, and I've kind of popped in one on an evening, and it's just highly recommend. Fantastic. It's kind of the same, you know, as the original movie premise, really. But kind of told from a different starting point and in a more of a TV way, to be honest. So you meet these two characters in episode 1 in the pilot, and they kind of are essentially doing a job interview to get accepted by this kind of shadowy agency that you, even 5 episodes in, you don't know a ton about. And they both get in, and then they are paired with each other, but they're both strangers. And then they become John Smith and Jane Smith, and then they get these missions. Basically, every episode they get a mission, and there's sort of short time jumps between each episode.
So they know that each of them are spies.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I guess that's quite different. That's a fairly different premise. Yeah, so that is different.
So this is like the Americans.
I think that's a fair comparison, having watched a bit of the Americans, yeah. But to be honest with you, it's a very grounded, while there are fun action and great sequences in the episodes I've watched, it's really just a very observational series about this relationship, this kind of strange relationship that these characters have met in this way and are thrown together. But also, is that different from a Tinder date? You know, like you are sort of, you know, in the dating world of 2024, strangers are thrust together as dates have always been, blind dates. And then you kind of follow these two characters who are kind of married to each other, but who are from the first episode strangers, and you see how that relationship changes, complicates, moves forward, and it's just two wonderful performances from Donald Glover and Maya Erskine, who I know she's in that Pen 15 show, and she's in that Christmas movie with Jack Quaid, but you know, I don't think I'd seen either of those things. So she's just a sort of sparkle.
Because I keep seeing it like pop up at the top of Amazon, and I feel like I recognize the name, so I must have heard her being talked about. But yeah, I did the same thing and kind of Googled and was like, no, I don't think I've seen her in anything.
The episodes are decently short. They're sort of, you know, 45, 50 minutes, so it doesn't hang around for too long. I think it's excellent. And I think the first episode is a really good. If you don't like the first one, then I'm not sure you're going to like the vibe, because it's a bit of a vibe, I would say. It's something specific, but the first episode is maybe still my favorite of the five and is a great sort of, it draws you in. Lisa drew me in. I highly recommend it. It's really one of the best things I've watched, in a bit. And
I hope it's literally really good. About half an hour before I came up to record the podcast, I saw that it was out on Amazon and I saw that Donald Glover was in it. And I was like, I'm going to watch that.
Yeah,
so really I'm glad to hear you say that.
Really good. And then that's it for me. That's it for me. James,
what about me? I think I've done two things of note since the last recording. The first thing that I watched was Enemy, which is a Denis Villeneuve movie. It's one of his earlier films. Might even be his first English language one. I'm not 100% on that.
I think it comes out after Prisoners, doesn't it?
Oh, does it come out after Prisoners? Okay.
I think it comes out like same year.
Was it made first?
2013 it was.
It's the spider one, right?
Yeah.
That's what I knew about that.
It's a Jake Gyllenhaal movie about a guy who discovers... I hesitate to say it's about this because it's clearly not, but it's about a guy who discovers someone out there who is his exact double, a sort of famous movie star who's living a different life to him, and you know, he has a wife and he's got his partner, and they become a bit obsessed and entangled with each other, and then at the end nothing gets resolved, and it's very sort of turns out to not be about anything the plot is about anyway, and it's it's more of a tonal, almost poem rather than a story. And I thought it was pretty bad, to be honest.
Yeah, I think
Joe said it was his favorite of all the Denis Villeneuve films, so I'm interested to hear why.
James and I already litigated this on a chat thread a little bit, but I mean, I haven't seen it for a long while, but I think I would have it close to the top of my Denis Villeneuve rankings. I think I've seen everything after, is it On Sundays? Is that how you pronounce it? I think I've seen everything. I think I've seen everything from there on. I really like it. I really like the Jake Gyllenhaal performance. I think Sarah Gadon's really good in it. And I kind of like the, I like the uncomfortable vibe of the whole thing. And the ending, it's one of those, and I said this to you, like, it's one of those things that I can completely get not vibing with the movie and going, well, that was dumb. But it's the kind of movie that I walk away from and I go, like, I liked that, and now I want to go away and think about why, and, like, try and, like, engage with the movie a bit more after watching. In the same way that I would probably walk away from some films and go, well, I didn't like that, so we're done. Like, I didn't enjoy the viewing experience, so I'm not gonna like give it any more space in my brain. I enjoyed kind of going away and like reading interpretations and, you know, what the filmmakers were going for, and I had a real good time with it. And I think that was like my favorite Jake Gyllenhaal period as well, because he did that and Prisoners and Nightcrawler kind of within a couple of year span. And I just think he was kind of like firing on all cylinders around then.
Yeah. I mean, he is great in it. That's certain. I think for me, I wanted a bit more of a sort of well-defined story. No, like, it doesn't even necessarily have to be a plot, you know, because this film did set up a lot of plot and then just sort of didn't really do anything with it. And ended up being more about, you know, the tone and psychology of the characters. I think if you come away from a movie thinking that was probably about something, but I've got no idea what, like either the failure is with the audience or with the filmmakers, and I'm predisposed to think it was probably them rather than me.
Yeah, you like yourself.
Because, you know, I've got a long history of understanding movies. So,
what's everyone's favourite Denis movie?
I think Arrival is a solid gold 5-star masterpiece, despite the fact it has Jeremy Renner in. I saw that in the cinema knowing nothing about it going in. I got invited to a screener, in fact, and I was like, I'm not busy that day. I'll go and see what it is. And I was just rapt from start to finish.
Yeah, Amy Adams, really good.
I loved Blade Runner. Maybe not everyone feels that way, but I just loved the mood, and that was such a vibes movie for me.
Blade Runner is weirdly great.
So good. And I love Dune as well, but it just felt like half of the movie, and very, very excited for Dune 2 like any minute. But Blade Runner, I think Blade Runner. But I haven't seen Enemy or Ensondes. But yes, I've seen the others, I think. Yeah.
Okay, and then the other thing that I've watched since we last recorded is, I don't know if you guys saw the Kevin Smith Masters of the Universe cartoon that was on Netflix a couple of years ago.
No.
Just nope.
A new season of that, 5 episodes. Mm. And again, it's properly fucking brilliant in a way that makes me think, oh, this is what Kevin Smith is supposed to be doing. Like, he shouldn't be making movies. He should be doing, like, 80s revival cartoons, because it is so...
Yeah, I would brilliant. Be on board for that.
Yeah. And like, it's 5 episodes, so there's no flab on it. It's just gets in, gets out. It's epic, it's emotional. And I wasn't even like a particularly a He-Man fan. But, you know, I'm just familiar enough with the canon to really enjoy it.
To memory, the commentary from the first season is they did some like mad stuff with the canon, like killed off loads of characters or did crazy stuff.
Yeah, well, it does things like, you know, characters are who were previously stuck in that sort of perpetual 1980s storytelling loop of this is He-Man's character, he's not going to change, get to expand a bit, you know, beyond that narrow range. And the same is true of this one. Like, it just is hard to convey just how like epic in scope it manages to be with these notionally ridiculous characters. And it makes me think like, oh, actually there are things you can do with this that are accessible to kids but also enjoyable for adults.
And how much is Kevin Smith like the author of the show? Is he...
Well, so he's the like showrunner / producer, and he writes like the opening and finale episodes.
Okay, so he's a showrunner and he's got... Yeah, okay. Because I do like what you're saying there is there's elements of Kevin Smith that I could absolutely believe is doing the things that you're saying he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know if I believe that he would do them, you know, if he was like the one man band, you know. So I think it's the benefit of having like a writer's room around him.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, I know from listening to his podcast, you know, back in the day, that he places a lot of stock in like emotional sincerity, and that comes across in these things. Like, there's the sequence where, you know, Oliver Tenure is getting attacked by Skeletor and his army or whatever, and He-Man like takes this moment to go and like save and comfort a child who is like hiding in an alley. And I watched that sequence going, like, I just know Kevin Smith was like sitting at his keyboard, like literally crying over his own words when he was writing this. But like, because of that, because it is sincere, it just works really well. I can recommend it as just a good time. Maybe not for you two. You two are probably too young for He-Man.
I've never watched a second of He-Man.
There you go.
No,
Kevin Smith's had such a crazy, what an insane career so far, right? Like, what a topsy-turvy kind of you know, what a mad career, like how he kind of got in, his rise to like a major name, and then quite, you know, quite a precipitous drop, and then this phase that he's still in now. You know, it'd just be interesting to see what he's doing in 20 years, you know.
I think it's fair to say he has a very distinct, I think, post healthscare phase, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because he was kind of becoming like actively antagonistic prior to that, and kind of mainstream Hollywood was done with him, and he did the whole thing where he like brought Red State to a festival and said that he was opening the bidding for distribution, and then like basically turned up and went, no, fuck you all, I'm not, like, I'm actually distributing it myself or something. And then he mm-hmm. organized press screenings for the film and then cancelled them day off because it's not about the critics, it's not about what they think. You know, it seemed like he'd also, like, responded really badly to the likes of Zach and Miri and Cop Out just, you know, dying on their ass. Yeah. You know, I'll be honest, I don't really like the movies that he's made since then, because I think they're a bit... I think he's ever been the most talented director, and I think they're a bit... It's like what you're saying, James, that like, I think that he's very good at... He can be very emotionally sincere, but he can also be like very flippant in what he's dealing with. And often that kind of like turns on a dime within minutes in a movie. And I'm like, oh, I'm not sure I'm going with this very emotionally sincere stuff right now.
Clerks 3 is a good example of that.
Yeah, Clerks 3 is, yeah, the kind of urtext of that. But I think I prefer this phase of his career to, you know, Tusk.
Sure, yeah.
But wouldn't it be? But also it'd be interesting to like watch, I don't know, Dogma and Tusk. And the first episode of this that he's the writer on, and be like, is this the same? You know, I wonder, does this feel like it's written by the same guy? You know, what connects these pieces? interesting.
Maybe we'll get a chance. Maybe we'll get a chance. We still don't know what you've picked.
Yeah, very true.
Reese has picked yoga hoses.
I saw that in the cinema.
I'm just like,
I think I saw Red State with you, Joe.
Starring as Nepo Baby, it does.
Yeah, it sounds possible. I don't know whether I've seen Yoga Hoses or not. I'm just looking at it. It feels possible.
You would remember if you had. Because the last third of the movie turns out unexpectedly to be about how movie critics are insane.
Is that the one with Lily Rose Depp in it?
That's the
one.
One
of the hoses?
And his own daughter.
Yep.
Hmm.
Yeah. I don't think I have. I think I've seen the others.
Is that all of your experiences, James, that you've had?
That's everything. It's everything I've watched, except for because Anna's never seen The X-Files, we're rewatching The X-Files.
Oh, cool. What's that like?
It's great. It's so 90s, and yet immediately the chemistry is there. Like, it's so... I saw someone describe it as like getting the two horniest people on the planet to make a show where they... don't want to fuck each other, and that's why it's so good, and it really is.
But yeah, it's funny you say that about X-Files, and I'm watching Mr. and Mrs. Smith, and then I'm reading some reviews for this show One Day, and you're looking at Paul Mescal's career and all that, how he pinged, but you know, he pings off of normal people, and you just go, you know what, Hollywood, maybe we're all just overthinking this a bit. Just give us two hot people with chemistry and put them in, and they're spies, or they're It's One Day Over Time, or they're young, or whatever.
Yeah.
That's really just what we want to see. That's what we
Listen,
want to see.
I'm sorry to have to go back to what I've been watching, but it ties in so perfectly. So I've mentioned this briefly. I've been watching these Mae West movies. So I've got the Indicator Mae West box set, and I'd never watched any of her films before. But like, she just comes out of the gate throwing fastballs, just immediately a movie star. And the film that I watched last night was called I'm No Angel, which she stars in, and Cary Grant is the like a very early Cary Grant performance. He's the like main supporting character, and the two of them are just hot, and they're and like the film is basically, the plot doesn't make, it's so dumb, but in any moment you're like, the thing that is happening on the screen right now is kind of built to what they are good at. Like, it's just playing on their strengths at all times. And you're like, there really was something to the star system of, I will turn up and watch a movie that stars that person and that person because they're hot and they have chemistry and I like them. I like their personas. And it's, yeah, I'm so with you. Just give us more of that.
Yeah, you know, you look at Anyone But You's been like a bit of a big hit, right?
It's stuck around, hasn't it? I mean,
yeah, and isn't that all that movie is? It's, you know, I haven't seen it myself, but some reviews are positive, some reviews are negative, but it's just two hot people that you want to see each other. It's just not that complicated, Hollywood, right? You figured this out. You figured this out 100 years ago, yeah. Like Joe was saying. So just go back to that. Go back to it. Go to Soho House. Go to Soho House in West Hollywood, and there'll be hot people there, and just put them in a movie, and then we're going to watch it. That's what you should do. They're there. You don't cut out the casting agent. They're just there. Go to a summer house. Easy.
How many Instagram followers they got, Reese?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you have to pick the top two. So yeah, but then again, you're in a summer house. There are probably some people with some high numbers. Yeah, definitely.
Fair point. Okay, that's everything we've been watching. We're now going to talk about one movie news story, which I have brought to the group.
Something that's interesting to James on the James episode of Cinematic Universe.
It doesn't matter what me and Joe think about it. It could bore us to tears. It doesn't matter. This is James' F.
That's why, I could make you talk about the Barbie Oscar nominations, but I think we've all seen enough takes on that. I don't want to bore myself as well. So instead, I want to ask what you guys think about Coyote versus Acme.
Ooh.
Which the news came out today that despite having previously cancelled it for tax purposes and then committed to shopping it around, the rumour today is that Warner Brothers were unable to find anyone willing to pay, I think, $75 million for the film they're going to get a $40 million tax break on. So they are officially deleting it and doing their best to do so quietly.
Done a good job at that.
yeah, they've Streisand it is what they've done there.
Yeah,
but yeah, I just think for this concept, which sounds really, really fun, it was produced and like original concept was by James Gunn, who is one of Warner's main guys at the moment. For a movie like this to get made and then shelved, I think you just look at the movie industry and go like, why does this exist? Like, are you sure you wouldn't rather be trading crypto or something?
It's
like Warner Brothers is a movie studio. It's supposed to be putting out movies. Yeah.
But they're owned by a conglomerate. And like, unfortunately as well, if you look, particularly if you look at the last 12 months, I mean, like, Warner Brothers won the box office last year. they kind of did, right? They had the hits, like Wonka was an overperformer, Barbie was massive, and like I think, yeah, it sucks, and that particularly, I think it's probably a result of the way that Warner kind of greenlit a lot of stuff and had this strategy for HBO Max when it was HBO Max, and then it wasn't anymore, but they'd already committed to stuff. And obviously there was the Batgirl stuff last year, and what was it? Was it a Scooby-Doo movie or something? Or
yeah, it was Scooby-Doo, like, Christmas movie or something?
Yeah, and obviously, and this is the latest one. And I kind of think it, like, as depressing as it is, after they've made the decision that they're going to write it off for tax purposes and that they're not going to release it, at the point where another studio doesn't meet their valuation of it, like, if for them, they're like, it's not worthwhile enough for us to sell this to someone else and it be a success and potentially be a success and like a kind of like a real embarrassment for us. The margin above which we are gonna, you know, it would have to be sizable on the balance sheet, wouldn't it, for them to do it? And it's depressing that we're talking about stuff in this terms, but the fact that we haven't seen it is only, I think, marginally less depressing than Disney deleting stuff within months of it showing up on the service. I don't think it's like a Hollywood studio problem. I think it's a streaming company problem. And the faster that we pivot away from it and back to a theatrical model, the better.
I mean, it does feel like the wheels are really coming off streaming, and this is a fairly big symptom of that. Although, did you see recently as well, Crunchyroll, which is a big anime streaming service, bought Funimation and then basically said, Funimation being another, their biggest competitor, basically. And they essentially said to all of the people who had bought movies through Funimation, we don't support this, so your purchases are now gone.
Well,
and so that's like next level beyond streaming doesn't work. That's like also, you know, that thing that people said wouldn't happen if you bought digital copies. Well, it just happened again. Like,
yeah, you don't own the thing.
I just wonder how many times can this kind of thing happen before people go back to buying DVDs?
Well, that market is growing again, I want to say. Although also, you know, there are less places, at least on the high street, to buy physical media. But I think the DVD numbers, or the, you know, sort of Blu-ray and DVD and Steelbook and all of it went up last year for the first time in a while, I think. Might just be pulling that number from my AS. Counterpoint is, maybe this movie sucked and maybe Warner Brothers couldn't really sell it because it's Looney Tunes, right? You can't have another studio or streamer put out a Looney Tunes movie, probably, because it's a Warner Brothers property. So you have a shitty movie that is too known about, right? Maybe that's also something that would have happened differently 20 years ago. But I think, you know, movies get canned, right? Or movies get, and maybe, you know, this sounds like it was expensive and finished, and, you know, with tons of CGI. But yeah, maybe this is also just, I mean, there's lots of stories, but this also could just be about the rising cost of movies. You know, it's as movies get more expensive, it is obviously kind of more and more ridiculous to shelve a whatever $200 million movie than it is to shelve a $40 million movie. And that also means that more people have worked on it at that higher price, because that's just reflects like hours worked, so people. And it must suck to, you know, what's the point of making this shit if it's not for audiences? And so the idea that it gets, as you say, deleted, that must be depressing for the vast majority of people that work on it. But I don't know, that's the game, baby. And maybe it sucked. And Fast X sucked. And
I was going to say, I think movies sucking has not been an impediment to their release.
Yeah, but maybe it should be more. Maybe it should be. Maybe they shouldn't put out movies that suck.
But
maybe,
like,
that's what they should do. And this is maybe this is that, or maybe this is that, and all these other things as well. It's a story.
That makes me wonder is that they weren't afraid to say that Batgirl sucked. With this, they were just like, no, we're not putting it out. Like, they didn't say it was bad. They didn't say it, you know, was too expensive to finish. Like, it was done. And they just went, no, we're not doing it. Presumably because some Excel formula somewhere said it's not going to make enough money.
But it isn't inherent in that it wasn't good enough, right? Like, that is what's inherent in there. It's not, because it wouldn't have gotten to this stage of existing if it couldn't make money in some way. But it perhaps it went, oh, this stinks, or this is, no, people aren't going to, this is not going to get any awards recognition. This isn't enough to now release on a theatrically because it's not good enough. And this is, we can't sell this to another streamer because it's a Warner, because it's Looney Tunes. So it will have to be on our, you know, have to be on our, on HBO, right? And so,
I sort of think what happened was Space Jam 2 crash landed and they went, okay, well, that's, people don't want that then. So this is the first casualty of that.
But probably what they ought to do is not, you know, it's just if they want to do Looney Tunes stuff, make it cartoons again. Give it, you know, hand it over to TikTokers or I don't know, right? Give it like an AI tool with only Looney Tunes skins and hand it to some influencers and see if they can put out, you know, 3-minute clips. I don't know, like that's, go back to its roots. Looney Tunes, maybe it should never have been, you know, it's a TV thing. It's short form. It that's what it should be. If it's going to be anything, it should be that, not the sound of this movie.
I think if you went to see a Batman movie and there was a Bugs Bunny short before it, everyone would go home happy,
regardless of the quality of the Batman film. They then watch Batman and Robin and they go, yeah, no, I didn't like that. But that short at the beginning with the rabbit.
Doing an impression of a movie star from the 1930s.
Yeah, worth the price of my $35 ticket. Yes, absolutely worth the admission.
Anyway, I hope this like streaming correction is coming to an end.
I think the Moana news is interesting this week. That Moana is something that was previously announced to be a streaming TV show is now going to be a movie. And it sounds like part of the motivation behind that was seeing how huge the streaming numbers have been for the first Moana movie and going, do you know, actually, it's one of our most popular titles on Disney Plus. Maybe we should put this out in cinemas and make money. You know, Mean Girls was going to be a streaming movie on Paramount Plus and has made Paramount a couple of $100 million, you know, just by putting that movie out into theatres that they were just going to pop on the streaming service beforehand. I think it's probably a good thing that the streamers are realising that, but also, you know, we are going to be in this tricky middle period where things are being retooled and, like, am I confident that a movie that for so long was a TV series and is now going to be a theatrical movie? Am I convinced that the quality of the animation, which especially after Wish came out, was kind of hammered for its, you know, visual sloppiness, that's now going to be a theatrical release? Like, is it good enough? I think, like, Disney seems all at sea at the moment, and they kind of seem like...
I've got a man with a small boat and some tattoos to show you. And he may or may not be voiced by Dwayne The Rock Johnson. He may or may not. He hasn't signed up yet. He actually might not be attached.
It just feels very...
He is attached, right?
No, he's not. That was another story.
Is he not? Okay.
Like, they're still in conversations because this news that Iger dropped was... Iger might have just decided that in the morning. Like, fuck it, we're going to... You know that man at Moana show? It's a movie. Oh, but you know we don't have The Rock or we don't have the Moana voice attached. Okay, well, we'll figure that out. You know, we've also announced... We've announced a Moana live action film that would come out 6 months
next
after this.
Year.
Okay, we'll figure it out. It's mad.
Yeah, as well. They feel like they are in like a re-hit of early 2000s Disney, only with a lot more content coming out. And I use the word content pointedly. But yeah, I think we're gonna, you know, I think the companies are starting to pivot away from streaming as the answer. But I think the knock on effects is going to be felt for a few years at least.
Yeah, I just know I'm never getting that fucking Armor Wars movie, am I? It's not happening. That's the end game here, is that James doesn't get his War Machine film because it won't fit on streaming and it won't fit in the cinemas.
Might be best for everyone if that was the case.
It's fine.
Are you all right, James?
No, it's fine.
He's been a Skrull since Civil War, James.
Yeah, maybe it's for the best. Maybe it's for the best. Okay. I think that's a fair amount of discussion on the news / non-story that a movie that no one has ever seen is not coming out. So let's have a quick listen to the trailer for Randall Park's Shortcomings.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I was practically the only non-white person in my entire high school.
And you never felt discriminated against?
I definitely did, but not because I was Asian.
Because of your inherent bad personality.
Exactly.
Do you remember that internship that I applied for?
What about it?
It's in New York.
New York is overrated. It's so gentrified now.
How many times have you even been there?
Are we counting layovers? You always assume the worst about me, and then you end up acting crazy over nothing.
I'm not acting crazy, so stop using that word.
You're just proving my point.
Are you two, like, broken up?
We're taking some time off. While the cat's away, the mouse
will play with himself, probably.
Can I kiss you? Sorry, I'm a little out of practice.
It's clear.
I'm gonna go to New York. Listen, maybe you could come with me.
I thought you came out here to clear your head.
I did. And then I met Meredith, and I've been there ever since. So when are you gonna see her?
I'm here to see Miko. She's an intern here.
Actually, I'm the only intern here.
You have problems with anger, depression, your weird self-hatred.
You could benefit from a little self-hatred.
Interesting.
I know you're gonna want to blame this on society or on your race or whatever, but this really is just about you.
Is this your rock bottom?
What is she doing with that guy?
They're being adorable.
So we finally get to meet your mysterious boyfriend. Huh?
Hello, Ben.
Hi.
Praise Jesus.
Maybe just be honest with him.
Is anyone sitting here?
No.
So, guys, I saw this movie at the London Film Festival in a cinema off Leicester Square with a packed house, and I loved it. It's based on a comic by Adrian Tamine, who is best known these days for doing these kind of wry, sort of satirical New Yorker covers. But back in the day, he was doing these kind of indie comics about hipsters in their 20s and, you know, their screwed up worldviews.
Did he do Black Hole?
No.
He did Wilson, right?
Also, no.
Is it not Wilson? Who's that?
Who did Black Hole? Or who did the comic Wilson?
Yeah, well, I guess we'll need now the answers to both questions.
Black Hole was Charles Burns. I have never heard of a comic called Wilson.
No, I know Wilson. Well, yeah, Wilson with about, and the front was like a fat guy. Side
no,
on.
Yeah, of course, yeah. It's Daniel Klaus, isn't it? You're thinking of
Daniel Klaus. Yes.
Okay, not same guy, same scene.
yeah. Because he did Ghost World.
Daniel Klaus did, yeah.
Yes.
Wilson. Adrian Tamine's work was called Optic Nerve.
Right. I've heard of that.
Yeah, the story within Shortcomings was three issues of Optic Nerve released about 20 years ago.
Shortcomings is 20 years old, like the original source.
I can see it.
Why so, do you? Yeah. I've got two questions for you that I'd like the answers for, James. Mm-hmm. Well, one is, do you know anything about why Randall, especially now that you say that's 20 years old, that's fascinating to me. Why did Randall Park want to make this? Question one. And question two, what did you like about it? I'm fascinated.
So question one, the reason Randall Park made this is because he was a fan of the comic. He felt it represented his life and, you know, him and his friendship circle. In a way that he didn't get from any other media. So when he had the opportunity to make a movie, you know, this was one of the things on his want list. And let's face it, Adrian Tamine. Go on.
What's the ethnicity of the characters in the comic? Because that was the one thing I read that that Randall Park said. I read Shortcomings and I was just like, this is me and my friends, I want to put this on screen, and yeah, I'm cashing my check and doing that.
Yeah, so the ethnicity of the character and Adrian Tamine is Asian American, specifically Japanese American.
Right.
The entire cast of the comic is Asian American.
It wasn't like
a race change.
Yeah, here are some white hipsters that I'm going to put kind of my experience on top of. It was, no, I'm literally looking at people who are like me and my friends.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, cool. Okay, that's good to know.
And yeah, I think probably one of the deciding factors is, like, let's face it, Adrian Tamine is not an expensive person to, you know, get the rights for story-wise.
He's got the screenplay credit, right?
Yeah, yeah, I was going to say, he wrote the screenplay. That I reread the comic, and it is evident to me that he pretty much barely changed a word. Like, it's so close an adaptation compared to, like, we've looked at a lot of comics adapted into movies, and nothing we've seen is as closely adapted as this. It's expanded in small ways. There's a bit of a twist on the ending. Broadly speaking, like
riff, what seems like a riff on Crazy Rich Asians at the start
that,
of this?
That
like
is that... the only significant addition beside the ending, and that is that they went more specific with the reference. In the comic, it starts with them coming out of the movie. In the film, it starts with the movie.
But in the comic, are they watching a film about Asian Americans or made by Asian Americans that is sort of doesn't feel authentic? Is that the movie they watch in the comic?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that surprised me so much when I went to the comic, was like, oh, actually, this conversation has been happening for 20 years, which was them saying, like, oh, I don't see why it can't just be a good film. Why does it have to be about representation? And I was like, wow. Like 2004, people were having that conversation, and here we are having it.
What would have been the...
What, the movie he's riffing on in Doe 4, I wonder, yeah.
That's the thing, I don't think it was a specific movie. I think back in the past, you know, he was just in that arts cinema
Crouching
scene.
Dragon?
Possibly.
That's 02 or 102?
I think it was more just independent cinema at the time, and, you know, he was seeing things that you see now, which is people get worked up over a movie due to its representation. When it's in a festival or something, and you go, okay, but is it actually good? And, like, you know, it's not wrong to get excited about seeing something that reflects your experience on screen, but it is interesting when you praise that before you praise the quality of the story, for example. But yeah, I was properly surprised to see how closely that conversation happens, because I was sure, you know, it was a Crazy Rich Asians riff.
And it is.
And yet, I mean, it is in the movie.
Yes, it is.
But this, you know, the source material has it in there 20 years before Crazy Rich Asians came out. So
that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't like this movie.
No, I got the sense. I got the sense.
And so I'm so curious what you, I'm just very curious what you, what you connected to. Because I found it such a hard, such a tough hang. I found the main character, it's just so dislikable, scumbaggy. and I bounced off that like from the off. And yeah. I think the problem I have is I think the movie isn't aware of that.
I disagree.
Are on different pages. And I really disliked it. I just really didn't want to spend any time with that guy from about a quarter of an hour in. And then it was another, it was short, it's 90 minutes. But this was tough for me. I really, really, really did not enjoy it. Struggled, didn't like it. And I thought it was a failure of the director, I think, and the tone. I was thinking a bit after I watched it about Inside Llewyn Davis, actually, weirdly. But I thought, oh, there's a movie where the main character's kind of a dirtbag who makes not even bad decisions, just is a shit to people, and yet that's one of my favorite movies ever.
So Llewyn Davis is a movie about a guy making bad decisions, self-destructive decisions, is caught in this kind of this loop of misery that is kind of understandable and contextualized by what's happened before the movie started. I think this movie knows that its protagonist is acting like a dick.
Yeah, just quickly, I would ask, if the movie doesn't know that, why is it called Shortcomings?
I'm not getting it right. What I mean is, the movie isn't calibrated enough for that. Obviously, it must know because that's the source material, and then the character is, you know, it acts that way. But I just think it's not critical enough of him, and I think the movie takes his side against the other characters, and I'm like, no, I'm with everybody else's. I'm on everybody else's page, not on your page, buddy.
But I don't think the movie.
And I think the movie's.
So I disagree. I'm in the middle. Where I think that. So I watched this and was immediately like, this is such a James movie. Because, like, first of all, it gave me those kind of ghost worldy kind of vibes of here is like a misanthropic lead, but who is kind of like poserish about it, right? That his kind of worldview seems so kind of like it's projected, or it's a shield, and that the real guy, which I think the movie is kind of saying, like, look, he's in there somewhere. There's a reason we're following this guy. He's not fundamentally a bad person. He just acts like a dick. And the movie is the journey to him realizing, like, you're not far away from being a good dude, but you kind of, and like it, and I think it calibrates kind of the situations around him to, like, it's not like all the people around him are good people and acting virtuously and righteously. Like, his girlfriend in the course of the movie does kind of fuck him over. Some of the situations his friend puts him in aren't ideal, but he kind of consistently handles them badly and talks to people poorly and doesn't process his emotions right. That was the first thing. The second thing, I was like, this is a Kevin Smith movie. Like, the vibes of this are so, like, this is Chasing Amy. Like, the protagonist that, you know, you have got, like, a 90s Kevin Smith protagonist who is a bit of a dick, but probably underneath it all is fundamentally a good guy if they can just sort their shit out. You know? This is a Kevin Smith character.
Go on.
I was like, this is... I can completely see why James likes this.
I hadn't drawn that connection, but I think, yeah, you're definitely correct.
Well, then, you know, then maybe it's a problem with casting, because I'm afraid Justin Min, plays the main character, isn't Ben Affleck, isn't Thora Birch, isn't Llewyn Davis, Oscar Isaac. You know, and he's just not, he doesn't sort of get away with it, at least from this audience member, for me, as a kind of, oh, you know, but he's got that star persona, and therefore I'm compelled to watch him be like a shit. He just is a boring, normal guy who's a shit to the people around him. And at the end, the movie, I think, gives him a pass, and I'm not sure he's learned that much. And so, yeah, I'm just, yeah. Or maybe that's a problem with direction. It's not like the direction of the film is particularly it's not directed with much panache, really, right? The setups are fairly straightforward. I'm not sure there's any particularly memorable bits of production design or framing or any of it. So it's not like Randall Park is helping Justin connect with the audience, and he's left to just flounder around in these scenes with being a shit to everybody. I think, for me, performers that I cared more about. So I thought Sherry Kohler as his friend was more interesting to me, and the girlfriend, I've just got Wikipedia up here, so I can't remember all the performers' names off by head. Ali Mackey, even, I thought was more interesting to me, but again, the movie he's the protagonist, he's the hero of the story, not even the protagonist, but the hero. Didn't do it.
So, I think after this, maybe let's go back to James and he can talk more about why he liked it. But I think for me, I think it's a tightrope with this kind of character, and I think for different reasons. But I kind of agree with you, Reese, that I don't think it successfully walks that tightrope across the course of the running time, because I think it kind of wants you to engage with him enough that you are with him over the course of the movie, but you also need to recognize that he's not a good person, or he's not behaving like a good person, and that at the end of the movie he's going to have to grapple with that. The problem for me was kind of a bit how linear it was between, like, he's doing all this and then suddenly he makes the realization at the end of the movie, and then you're kind of asked to go, like, yeah, everything he did do was shitty, and I think some of the scenes and the observations throughout, like, I thought it was more interesting when the movie is naughty. So, like, because his girlfriend kind of she's handled the situation really badly, right? She could have broken up with him, but she doesn't. Mm-hmm. She moves to New York, shacks up with another guy, makes up the internship, and kind of leaves the scope there for him to go down this, you know, this like spiral, trying to figure out what's been going on. It doesn't make it like, he still doesn't deserve to be with her, and he doesn't, you know, that it's not a relationship that we are or should be rooting for. It's pretty obvious from early on in the film that it's broken. Like, that's more interesting to me than at the end of the movie, him just going, yeah, I've been a bad guy and I need to change. I think... Actually, the Crazy Rich Asians thing, I think, is kind of, like, indicative of the movie. Like, I think it just lacks a bit of bite, because the start of the movie, him having that rant and going, like, it's not about representation. It shouldn't be about representation first. What, like, shouldn't the movie actually be good or whatever? Or like, and you're like, this is interesting from director Randall Park, who spent 5 years on a sitcom working alongside the lead of Crazy Rich Asians. Mm. And, one of the most prominent, you know, Asian American people in film, you know, star of Marvel and DC. And the end of the movie goes, yeah, no, I was wrong. It's good. It's just good that these things exist. And we should like this. And you go in like, oh, but there was something in what you were saying at the start, right? There is something to that. Now, it might be the case that, you know, we can have that debate and go, like, it's probably still a good thing that Crazy Rich Asians exists. It's probably not a good thing that people praise stuff just for representation alone, or praise that first before they get to anything else. But the movie doesn't want to have that debate. And I kind of felt like there was scenes throughout as well where he was having those, like, there's this scene where, well, there's the whole thing about him kind of fetishizing white girls. And like, there's clearly stuff in that that's not healthy, and there's people kind of trying to talk to him about, like, why do you think Asian American guys do fetishize white girls? Like, do you not think there's something wider in that? And he refuses to engage with it. But then there's the moments where, like, he's having the argument with his girlfriend when she sees that he's been watching white girl porn, and you kind of want to be on his side, where you're like, look, it's a private thing, and he's engaging in something that he's got a fetish in, and you shouldn't really have to explain it to you. But then also the way that he just completely dismisses the fact that he's been watching pornography and not having sex with her, mm-hmm. and then the way that he kind of, like, debates her about it, and you're like, dude, you got caught watching porn, don't have it. And you're like, but there's something there that you're like, all right, there is this push and pull. And I think increasingly as it goes through, the movie moves away from that push and pull, and it just becomes about him not being a good person. And like I say, just being very black and white about things at the end. So that's where I think it doesn't quite walk the tightrope. But I'm very interested, James, because you kind of, and be interested, you know, you said you saw it at a public screening as well, and kind of how it landed in that context.
Yeah, I mean, my sense coming out of the movie is that, you know, it was a very receptive crowd that enjoyed it a lot. Like, you know, it is a comedy. It's a borderline romantic comedy, comedy drama maybe. But there were lots of big laughs. Like, people really took it in. I think when I came out of the movie, I was super hot on it. Like, rewatching it, I was like, okay, maybe some of this stuff doesn't work. I agree with you guys that Justin Min isn't necessarily, you know, hitting the charisma that maybe this character needs.
I don't think he's too far off, though. I don't, like...
No, he's close. I find some of the... I
dislike him as a screen presence, but...
Yeah,
I think you're right that he's not Ben Affleck. I mean, that's true.
Sure, yeah.
But you know who would have been good as the lead? Randall Park. Right? You know, he's too old, I guess.
That's, I was going to say, 15 years ago, maybe.
But that he has the charm. He has, you know, he's got buckets of charm. And in a way, this kind of film, this kind of role is would have been a showcase in ways that he's had so rarely in his career. So it's a shame, because I think it would have been good for him as a leading man, and it would have made the movie work for me. I don't know, but Randall Park I like and has got it, and I'm just not sure that Justin Min does.
I do think some of his energy is, you know, it's a bit lacking. Like, sometimes he's doing these rants and he sounds a bit bored, and I'm like, if you really gave it some welly, if you really, like, more rants it, like, if you were shouting this stuff like it was the most important thing in the world, maybe I'd buy it a bit more than your kind of dispassionate, you know, inaccessible delivery.
And I wonder if that's something that's a slight drawback about making it now versus making it in the late 90s, that the film industry had space for that kind of thing in a way that it doesn't now. An indie film has less of a space for it now. Mm-hmm. And also just, you know, like, today's 20-somethings are more like this than they are like that.
Maybe, yeah, I mean, more well-adjusted than this guy.
It might have been more interesting as a period piece, actually, to say this is set in 04, because it isn't. It's set now. But obviously that makes it more expensive, because you've got to do some period dressing, and maybe that's a drawback. But yeah, I thought it was a new piece, but when you say it's actually 20 years ago, that totally reads then in hindsight. And actually, he should have lent much more into that than to try and kind of ignore that. Or as you said, James, the Termine script is almost word for word his comic from 20 years ago. I do wonder whether, you know, work after that period of time, 20 years, it needs to be updated, doesn't it? Often it does.
Yeah. I mean, before we get to that, because there are some things I want to say about that, but initially I think the thing that I connect with in this work, it's similar to the comic, right? So when I read the comic, what I saw was this kind of pop culture obsessed, guy with a girlfriend who's his like way into culture and conversations is kind of, doesn't this suck? Why do idiots enjoy this stuff? You know, maybe there are ways I can use my knowledge about this to, you know, manipulate people. And, you know, I am smarter than everything around me. And in my early 20s, that was kind of what I was like. And the original Shortcomings comic was one of the things where I read it and went like, oh, maybe being a cynical asshole about everything all the time isn't fun for the people around you. Like, it works for you because you get to feel good about about your opinions and your, place in society.
Sitting there thinking you're morally superior to Denis Villeneuve's enemy.
For example.
I just never thought this guy was the smartest guy in the room, I think. Maybe that's also
well, no, but
that's
he
the,
clearly...
That's what the character's supposed to be.
He thought he was, right? That's the difference. Like,
he seems so dispassionate, though. I don't know that he doesn't seem to care. You know, at times he cares, but often he just seems to sleepwalk through scenes.
I mean, yeah, I agree. Like, the sleepwalking is a problem, but more with the performance than the writing. I think, like, he's clearly, like, in that, when they have that discussion and he's talking about representation, you know, versus quality, what he's done is he doesn't like that people enjoyed something he thought was stupid and he's intellectualized it. And she's saying, like, well, you know, maybe not everything has to be for you. Maybe just let people enjoy what they enjoy. But he is so determined to bring everyone else down that she fully checks out of the relationship, right?
Yeah.
And that is something I can relate to. Because, like I say, that's the kind of thing I would have done in my 20s.
And I'm sitting there wondering, though, like, is there a version of this movie which ends with him going, like, I can still think these things. I just have to be a dick. I don't have to be a dick about them. You know, it doesn't have to be like, let's end the movie with like smiling at Crazy Rich Asians and going, do you know what?
Maybe it is good, yeah.
Pretty good, actually. Because it does look like horse shit, that thing that they're watching. it's what, Stephanie Sue and, what's the guy's name? I can't remember. He's funny. Eddie?
It's Ronnie Cheng.
Ronnie Cheng. Yeah. He's funny. Yeah. I like him.
Yeah. So to circle back on Reese's point about, doesn't this work need to be updated? So the change they made in the ending, right, is that the finale of the comic is that this guy has, like, gone to New York, alienated his friends and partner, and, you know, through his own stubborn mindedness rejects all offers of help given to him and goes back to his hometown, like,
so not alone, like, not the,
yeah
okay,
and he goes back to LA, like, completely dejected and isolated and alone, and the final sequence is him on the plane sort of staring out the window with the implication that he is reflecting on how, you know, his shortcomings have led him to this point.
Interesting.
And I can see why they took that and went, okay, can we give this a more upbeat ending?
So I wrote down in my notes when I was watching this that it felt like the movie had run out of steam and that it had kind of done what it needed to do. And it was ready to end. And then he goes to New York. And so I kind of mean that, like, because he hits rock bottom kind of before he goes to New York. And whilst when he gets to New York, there are the revelations around about what his girlfriend did. And he kind of fucks up his relationship with his friend a bit more. Like, it was all basically done before that. And most of what's happening in New York with the revelations around the girlfriend and stuff is him realizing, you know, kind of like him putting himself into these more elevated situations where he realizes. I kind of felt like the movie had, like, it had done all the exploration of that. And then kind of New York had run out of steam. Although I did like Ex Machina Girl, Snoyo.
Yes.
I don't know.
Mizuma?
I'm not looking at IMDb at the time, but she's been in a couple of Alex Garland films, hasn't she?
Yeah.
Mm. And I thought she was great, and because I had not expected such a cut glass British accent to come out of her mouth as well. So that was that was enjoyable. And I thought she was really good value. Sonoya Mizuno. And Timothy Simon's very funny as the, what's he call him? Fried rice?
Rice King.
Rice King. Yeah.
That performance is so heightened but hilarious for every second.
So is that character also in the comic from 20 years ago? That's all the same too?
Yes, although he looks very different.
Sure.
You know, they've updated the hipster design.
Yeah.
Can we talk about the single worst moment in the movie?
Go on.
The fourth wall breaking Jacob Batalon talking about Spider-Man.
No, movies. I thought that was cute.
I thought it sucked.
I quite like that, actually. In a rare moment of, I think I enjoyed that. And all that, I have to say, as someone who has worked in the cinema for basically my adult life, I really should be in the bag for all that stuff. And actually, gosh, I found that.
I thought really that was going to be the vibe. There was the TikTok guy who does the IKEA videos, and there was the Genki, and I was like, oh, is this like, again, this? Oh, that's when I was thinking Clerks as well, right? That we basically got Jay and Silent Bob there, and he is a Dante I'm just like, yeah, okay, this could be the vibe. And then we kind of veered away from it, and I didn't think the stuff with the white girl that he hooks up with I'm aware now he hooks up with two, or he tries to hook up with two white girls, doesn't he? The girl who comes to work at the cinema, I thought was less interesting.
Autumn, yeah.
The Sasha, the Debbie Ryan character, I thought was more interesting, and I thought that their kind of like breakup scene was one of the better ones in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, the point of those characters is sort of to have him confront his, you know, particular attractions, because it's clear early on he's got nothing in common with Autumn. Like, he just thinks she's hot. And he, you know, manipulates her by lying to her, because he's like, no, I want to
watch her on CCTV. It's icky.
Yeah. He's like, I want to have sex with this girl because she's white and hot, and that's what I'm into. And then with Sasha, it's a bit more developed, and he clearly thinks like, oh, you know, I'm making some progress with this. And then, you know, she turns out again to be not right for him, and he turns that into a failing of her.
With Sasha, I think there's a sense that this is maybe something that could work if you were well adjusted, and she didn't have the other person kind of lurking, but he's got the other person lurking as well. Whereas the other one just felt, you know, broken and silly from the start, I was like, I can invest in this character. Also, I think that Sasha feels like a real character, whereas Autumn feels like a sketch.
Yeah.
I think an early point where I thought, oh, me and this movie are just not on the same wavelength is when he goes, I think it's the first time he goes around Autumn's house, and she's She's got all the pictures on the wall of the of her urine.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just so kind of, I think the movie is with him and is laughing at her in that, at that moment, I my view, and laughing at when she's performing in the band. And I just thought, I wasn't so on the other side. I was like, here's this young woman who is your, you know, underling and you're manipulating, and she's trying. She's out there trying to make art, actually. She's trying.
Yeah,
and
she's doing the thing that you profess to want to do.
And again, actually, you, Ben, and the movie, I think, is laughing at her for doing that. And
but
I was
in,
like, I'm just not,
in that
I
moment,
I'm
because the movie validates it later on. And again, I kind of wish that there was more nuance between, like, ha, this thing is dumb. Who is this stupid girl? And then later on, like, actually what she's doing has its worth. And going, you know, is there a middle ground there with, you know what, it's great that she's out there doing this thing, trying to make art, but also we can kind of go, that's dumb and stupid, right? Because that's what he thinks. Like, that's okay. And, like, you don't have to be a dick about it. But, like, the movie doesn't. Yeah. It kind of goes from one extreme to the other. And I do wonder whether there's something in, like, Randall Park just seems like such a nice guy.
Yeah,
he just seems like such really an affable guy. And that, when you get to the end of the movie, you're like, you're not surprised that he's just trying to kind of, like, make good and go, like, and by the way, I don't think these things, right? Just so we're clear.
I mean, so this is, again, there was a point that I was trying to get to and we sort of veered off it, which is that one of the things about this movie that I found really interesting, and that actually friend of the podcast, Mike Leader of Ghibliotech, pointed out to me, is that it, in a way, it sort of lines up with things like Scott Pilgrim Takes Off, in which a sort of indie cartoonist from the early noughties is reevaluating the perspective of their work written in the 20s, written in their 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of, like, whether it came from the director or whether it came from the screenplay writer, Tamine, like, it looks like them going, actually, you know, maybe I was... Even in recognizing that I was being a dick, I was not fair to the people around me while I was trying to grow. So, like, you know, in the comic, Autumn's artwork just happens, and the point of that is, like, these two people are so different, they can't get along. I don't necessarily agree that they're making fun of her in the movie. In the comic, it's definitely like, this girl is nuts. Like, you've got nothing, you've got no reason to be here. But the comic doesn't have that note of, oh, actually, she turned out to be successful, that is in the film.
Mm.
In the comic, it's just, she's nuts, get out of there. And I think some of the, like, if you see any cynicism in the movie, that is a relic of the comic, because he was a much more cynical writer and artist back in the day, and he's softened substantially.
But I wonder, maybe the these are the wrong people to make a, maybe the Randall Park, smiley, cheery, seems very nice, and an older Adrian Tomine who's softened up are not the right people to adapt shortcomings from 20 years ago. Because actually, what you need to make that piece and make it true to itself is the heart and eyes of a cynic, you know. And actually, this movie, it's like it's pulled in those two different directions. You know, that ending you described sounds like the cold, horrid, true cynical ending of the story that you kind of watch in the movie. But Park and an older Tomine feel that they don't want to do that to an audience, which, and I get it, but then tell a different story, you know, because maybe this story should have ended in that way.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the ending in this movie is invalid. Like, I think it's interesting that what they went with was, you know, it's possible to grow. Maybe this isn't the end. Maybe this is the start of him being a better person, like clean slate and everything. Because, you know, he could have stayed in New York and he could have been a hanger-on. But what he actually did was say, no, actually, I want my life there and I'm going to go find it. You know, he's happy to be home at the end, whereas in the comic, you're just left with this lingering, like, this guy is fucked feeling.
You're going to just open the emergency door and just...
Yeah. Like, he's got nothing and he's returning home to nothing. Whereas, at least in the movie, Ben is like, well, at least I like being in the city and this is where I want to be. So that's something. What point was I going towards there? I think one of the things that has happened with, you know, the perspective that has been gained over 20 years is that they're a bit more empathetic to the 20-year-old versions of themselves, even as they were, you know, recognizing their flaws. They were saying, like, listen, you had those flaws, but so did everyone else. Like, there's not a character in this film that doesn't, you know, make some mistake and do something unfair. And I think that's a little bit of extra nuance that the comic doesn't necessarily have either. I'm thinking specifically of, like, Meredith, you know, reading him the riot act and getting kind of like haughty about her intellectual credentials, you know, telling him that he doesn't understand himself or whatever, and stuff like that makes me think, like, they took care in this movie to make sure not everyone was, like, morally unimpeachable.
I think that's fair. I think it does feel like this is a movie full of flawed people. It's just he is the most flawed.
He is the most flawed. Yeah.
I watched Marriage Story. I watched like the last chunk of it actually with my mum the other week, and you know, that movie just has that incredible scene, the big argument scene between the two of them. And you know, if you compare that with the scene that these two characters have towards the end, the Marriage Story scene for me is one about, hey, these are two flawed characters that are, you know, going through this, you know, real trajectory within the scene and being exposing themselves up to and each other up to all this shared history and yeah, I don't know, that when done really well with the ambiguous, the morally ambiguous characters in a relationship, those are just some of the, those are incredible scenes of cinema. And I saw Anatomy of a Fall last year, like a similar scene right at the heart of that is one the best scene I saw all year. And yeah, this didn't have that, but it would have been better if it did. And I think the performance is part of that. Of course it is. And the direction and the script.
Stand up for Justin Min. Justin Min, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
still not looking at the IMDb. I want to stand up for him slightly. I think he's fine in this. I don't think it's like a movie crashing performance.
No.
He's also very handsome. He's a cutie, and you're like, I can see why you. Can see why people gave you rope up until this point.
Sure.
Yeah, you know, I don't think he's terrible. I just think you can look at this movie and go, there's a better version of that performance that isn't on screen, you know? Mm. And so when it does fail, it's hard not to go like, well, he's the main character. He's trying to carry everything. Sometimes he can't.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to carry a movie. It's hard to carry a TV show. It's hard to act in big stuff. It's hard. These are hard things. It's hard to carry a film. And I think in some ways, especially with, you know, with this project, the way it is, it's Randall Park is, I think, has asked too much of this young actor. You know, I don't think he is. He will be quite young. I think that, and I think ultimately Randall, it's on him of that. That's, you know, he will have cast him essentially and he will have directed him. So I kind of, you know, this guy doesn't have it, or at least not in this film, but it's ultimately that's Parks. And I think if that had gone differently, this movie, as the kids say, hits different. If that bit had gone differently.
well, for the first time, Reese, you're older than James.
I'm sure, oh my God, I can feel my hands.
I've just remembered something else that I'm sorry, I didn't like, and I want to point this out. The opening shot of the movie, the three of them with the title card, the shot, you know, where they're just like stood in front of a road.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the three, I was like, one, I thought it looked bad. And two, you're setting me up for a different movie there. Cause I'm like, right, I'm sat down, I'm like, okay, I'm going to explore this movie about these three people and how they interact. This friendship group. Mm-hmm. And then, two of them, I don't think ever talk.
Never share a scene. Yeah.
No, never share the screen. I wouldn't have done that if I were.
It's interesting because
I obviously would have made a better movie than
him. I would simply have made a better movie.
A better film.
I simply would have had fewer shortcomings.
So my interpretation of that, and I agree it's weird, is that he was trying to do a thing that looks like one of Tamine's prints. Yeah.
But it doesn't. It looks bad.
Yeah, and in the same vein, I think it's such a like classic indie film thing to do, to intersperse title cards throughout the story, that bear no relation to what's going on.
Oh, what were they? Remind me.
I can't even remember, but
they're about six, right?
Yeah, there are a bunch of them. Yeah. You know, in true sort of. Like mistaken idea fashion, there's a lot at the start and then they taper off dramatically towards the end.
I'm trying to remember like, what they're saying.
I don't
though.
Even
they're
remember
like...
if there are any towards in the New York sequence.
There's one that's some kanji, right? Towards the end, there's one that's not in English.
Is there?
I thought.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. But yeah, I don't remember what they were. And I don't think they added anything to the story either.
Clearly.
They're not even in the comic, so I don't know quite where they came from. Like I say, it just feels to me like, you know, the director was like, oh, you know, I'm making an indie movie, so we're going to slightly elevate it by implying there's some kind of, you know, this is some kind of vignette rather than...
Yeah, but what's funny is that feels like indie movie shit from 20 years ago. That doesn't feel like how these movies are made anymore. If they're even made... I mean, you know, the truth is that the indie scene that I guess with this movie was made at the time or 20 years ago, it does not exist in the same way these days. It completely doesn't. And we keep joking about TikTokers and stuff, but actually it probably is true that the kind of person that 20 years ago would have tried to become an indie filmmaker is now making TikToks and
making TikToks where they stuff a giant burger into their face and then give a thumbs up.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I get those too. there's an inauthenticity to that, to both what the story as told set in the modern day and Randall Park dressing it up like an indie movie from now that only existed 20 years ago.
I do think that you're right that it would have been better as a period piece, but maybe the reason I respond to it so well is because it reminds me of those movies that I loved. And, you know, if it is a pastiche, I'm fine with that because it's stuff I like. But yeah, I think that those are valid criticisms.
I didn't mind spending time with it. I kind of came out really middling on it. I thought it had its moments. There were sequences that I enjoyed more. I didn't hate it, but I do. I just thought it was such a difficult tightrope to walk with that central character, and it just doesn't. And I think crucially, doesn't stick the landing for me.
Before we wrap up, did you guys find it funny? Because the thing, first time I saw it and second time I saw it, I got proper big laughs, like, all the way through. Like, there was tons of stuff in here.
Sporadically, I would say.
Was properly hilarious.
Yeah, absolutely sporadically. I mean, and it's hard to replicate, you know, there would have been some leftover fluids from... That sounds weird. Oh. I mean, you would have had memories of your initial viewing in the cinema, James, and I would have had a funnier experience in a cinema, especially in a festival cinema, of course, but... I'm not sure I laughed once. I wouldn't even, if you'd have asked me what genre is that, I wouldn't have said comedy, actually. I wouldn't think of it as a comedy at all.
I mean, I've had that experience with movies before. And I, you know, sometimes it's very hard, but I feel like there are some things in here that are objectively jokes.
And you, but you, Great. I didn't see the direction that sentence was going in. I think you also probably, James, saw it in like the perfect, like, I can't imagine this played to many packed houses around the world after after its festival run.
Well, it barely got a release here. Like, I think it was straight to VOD here. Came out during the strike. I mean,
I saw it, but I just don't think it was on my radar at all before you mentioned it.
Yeah, I mean,
I also bet that the London one you saw would have been populated with like mostly you, like you, who probably knew the source material. So again, just a perfect screening.
Yeah, well, I had a similar one. You know, keep bringing it back to Kevin Smith, but I had a similar experience for Clerks 3, where I saw it at the Prince Charles with an audience of Kevin Smith fans and loved it.
Yeah. And then that, everyone and that else film, and that film like, does suck. Cloying nonsense.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that. It worked for me. Cloying nonsense, though, it is. Okay, I think we've touched on everything that I wanted to talk about for this.
This is good. I'm enjoying this format. I'm enjoying having things sprung on me. It was nice, I think, as well, to have something different, like that you'd picked out this week that, you know, you were coming with a perspective on, whereas last week I was just like, I'm going to see Poor Things. Should we do that?
Yeah, and I appreciate you guys taking the time to watch it and staying awake, staying awake for the whole thing.
Well, I've got news. Big news. Big reveal news, because you will need to stay up a little longer and watch my film selection for the next episode. Because of course, what we'll be watching next week, of course, it's 1981's Reds, directed by Warren Beatty. And yes, it is 3.5 hours long. So it's probably a two-night. That's pretty fun. Go Chiefs!
Do you want to give us any context for why you're choosing Reds?
Any context for why? It's on my watch list, and you guys haven't seen it, according to Letterboxd. That's it. That's the list. That's it. Right. Why is it on the watch list? I couldn't really tell you. I have certainly never seen it, but it stars Warren Beatty, who you may have heard of. It stars others as well. Oh, Diane Keaton, Jack Nicholson, Paul Sorvino, and it's about American in socialist Russia. And incredible stuff. Incredible stuff. I can't wait. But it's long. So wow. I think, yes, it's a two-nighter, I think. Probably realistically it's a two-nighter. that's my energy. Reds. Let's do it. Reds.
Sounds good. Where can we find Reds?
I don't know. That's not my problem.
I just looked. It doesn't appear to be streaming for free anywhere, but it is rentable at pretty much, you know, anywhere that you rent your movies from.
Beautiful.
YouTube, so if Amazon, you listen, if we... Apple TV, etc.
So if you're listening to this for free, listener, know that every Patreon sub, if you haven't already, it helps to us to pay the bills to watch Reds. So please do try and assist if you can. Every little helps.
All right. Let's suck it up. We will also be watching Madam Web, I assume, at some point.
I mean,
sure.
We've got to.
And if we manage to all see that, we'll be reviewing it on the Patreon. And if we don't all manage to see that, I'll be reviewing it on the Patreon. So,
God. And the episode will have to be as long as the movie Reds. So it have to be at least 3 hours and 20 minutes. That is the rule.
James, if that does happen, all I'm saying is, I hope you know where your bell is.
Okay, well.
We did it.
Got through another movie. We'll be reviewing Reds in the next episode in a couple of weeks. And possibly Madam Web. Who knows? You can find out by subscribing at patreon.com/cinematicuniverse. You can find me at letterboxd.com/cineversejames.
I'm on Twitter, @Cunningham14 on Letterboxd.
I'm on Twitter @Reese. Follow me on Twitter. Yeah, I'm still doing it. I'm tweeting, baby. I mostly retweet, but the funny stuff.
Thanks for listening. We'll be back in a couple of weeks.
Goodbye, podcast.
Podcast. Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.